This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. To reassess one of the most important figures of World War II, I think it's fair to say. We're talking about Fleet Admiral Ernest King. So, Dr. Kuhn, if you could start us off, kind of the one-sentence bio. Who is Ernest King?
Ernest King has got to be the most powerful admiral who ever controlled forces in war in the history of man. By the time we got to the end of his tenure as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet, and Chief of Naval Operations in World War II, he commanded a fleet that consisted of over 3,000 major warships and something like 7,000 warships, if you throw in all the various amphibious warship types that were being employed by the end of World War II. So probably the most powerful admiral to ever command, and command he did. And so that's the first thing we need to know about him. The second thing we need to know about him is that it was said Admiral King only had three weaknesses: women, booze, and foul language. and I think this ended up in one of his biographies. I think the Thomas Buell biography. And it's one of the great myths about King, and it's sort of led to King being dismissed to some degree by historians over the years, and so we'll address all of those three things as we talk about Ernie King.
So as part of this reassessing series, you've kind of already led us here, but let's get it out. What is the book on King? When people think about Ernest King and the history of the Navy in World War II, what's kind of the popular image?
Well, he's an incredibly complex guy with one of the most fascinating careers in the history of military professionalism. Okay, so that's the first thing. He's really complicated. The book on him has tended to be one of the best strategists of World War II, but he was acerbic and arrogant and hard to get along with. So that's the book, quote-unquote book, on Ernie King.
Okay, so let's dive into the material here. He obviously is a World War II admiral, and he has this deep background. You mentioned it's a complex one. So start us at the beginning. Where does he come from? How does he start his career?
So King, like all great naval officer, comes from Ohio. He was born in Lorain, Ohio, on the shores of Lake Erie. He gets an appointment to West Point, and he goes to West Point. And the bulk of the admirals in World War II are going to be, or not West Point, excuse me, Annapolis. The bulk of the admirals in World War II are going to be Annapolis guys, and King fits that he fits with that whole idea that all these great admirals came out of Annapolis, and they did.
So forgive an ignorant Army instructor question. In the Army of this period, you could reach command not having gone to West Point. Is that an option for Navy?
Very, very rare that you would ever make admiral in the Navy prior to 1939. In fact, it's hard for me to think of anybody who had. I think I know my friend at Naval War College, Dave Conan, who wrote the definitive biography of Ernie King called King's Navy. Probably knows, and there are other naval historians that probably know, but I can't think of a single admiral who prior to 1939 who was not an Annapolis grad. There may have been some Annapolis grads or some non-Annapolis guys who managed to make admiral in World War II, but the period for somebody who was a reserve officer training corps or an OCS guy to go from ensign or lieutenant to Admiral was very, very short, and very few of them did it. There were ones after the war who were not Annapolis grads. But during the war, just all of the major admirals, every time, even the admirals who were in command of mostly reserve naval forces, like Taffy 1, Taffy 2, and Taffy 3 at Lady Gulf, those guys are Annapolis guys. Ziggy Sprague is an Annapolis guy. Okay. So Ernie King is an archetype of the Annapolis grad of the period.
What year group is he?
So I think he's either 1900, 1905. It's in here in his book. I was going to...
Early
1900s. And again, all of his contemporaries from Annapolis are names that you'd recognize. William Halsey, Frank Jack Fletcher, Betty Stark, Leahy, all these guys, all the guys who were the guys in World War II, Spruance, Raymond Spruance, they were all Annapolis guys. And Peter Karsten calls them Annapolites.
And he's a contemporary of Marshall in terms of year group. I forget the exact year for Marshall, but plus or minus right in there.
So we're going to fast forward. So King comes in at a very, very interesting time for navies. He comes in during the period when there's all this change in navies. And so he's coming into a navy that is centered on ships as machines, centered on all this new technology with torpedoes, submarines, and airplanes. And King is going to be involved in all of them. Mm-hmm. And not just in passing, but in a major way. In many ways, King can be considered one of the fathers of naval aviation. But he can also be considered one of the fathers of the submarine force. And of course, King knew his way around a battleship. So King had all the bases covered. If he was in the Navy today, he would be wearing dolphins, wings, and a surface warfare pin. He'd have all three. He's an incredibly competent person. He was fascinated with military history. He's probably the only admiral that I've ever read about who knew the names of all Napoleon's marshals and could tell you who they were, what they did, and what was their most famous battle. He was that kind of guy. Just an incredible mind. I don't know if he slept. and by the time we get to the end of World War I, he's a captain. He's a very senior officer. He's a captain. He's serving on the staff of Admiral Henry Mayo of the Atlantic Fleet. He's sort of in opposition to Admiral Sims, who's running the flagship for European operations with the British. And King will earn his Navy Cross doing that job for Henry Mayo in the Atlantic. He'll get a Navy Cross. But mostly as a staff officer, not really in command of a destroyer. Like Jack Fletcher will get a Navy Cross, but he'll actually be commanding escorts in anti-submarine warfare. So King is well established as an up-and-comer in the Navy. Everybody knows this guy is going to make admiral. And he gets in early into submarines beyond surface ships. But his experience is very much centered on surface ships as well. So he'll come into the aviation community, though, because of some things we'll talk about.
So, John, one of the things that's interesting is, like, to flip over to the War Department side of things, the Army. In the Army, a lot of the people after World War I, when they're playing with experimental things, their branches kind of put the kibosh on them. Like the famous example is George Patton writing about an independent armor force. Cavalry branch told him, hey, cut that stuff out. Eisenhower, same thing. Infantry branch told him, hey, cut out all that stuff talking about independent tanks. Tanks are infantry support. Is he encountering the same problem from his community when he's going into submarines or aviation?
Well, this is the fascinating thing about the Navy of the period, is that the entire paradigm through which we've observed the Navy of the period has been this old traditionalist battleship admirals versus all these new up-and-comers and submarines and airplanes. And nothing could be further from the truth. The Navy Officer Corps, which is relatively small, even though this is soon to be the second biggest navy in the world and soon to be one of the two biggest navies in the world in the interwar period before World War II, is that basically the U.S. Navy is a bunch of generalist officers all on track for command, and they all are at heart sailors who like to be on ships, But, and they can command ships. They have to command ships, given the career track for everybody. But you'll basically have a Navy with surface guys who are interested in submarines and surface guys who are interested in airplanes and surface guys who just want to stay in the surface Navy. So this sort of tight compartmentalization you see with the combat arms in the Army doesn't apply to the Navy. If you want to be in submarines, that's fine. You can command a floating dry dock, and your career is fine. So you cannot command anything after commanding a minesweeper and become the father of the nuclear Navy, Hyman Rickover, in this Navy. So this is an incredibly interesting Navy that has too often been pigeonholed as a bunch of old fuddy-duddy traditionalists. When in point of fact, the dreadnought Navy guys of this period are the up-and-comers. The dreadnought was a fascinating brand new technology that wowed the world when it appeared on the world stage in 1906. So we often forget that the guys who are the battleship admirals are actually a new breed. Mm-hmm. They're not the old breed. They're what Scott Mobley, in his book called Navy Progressives in Blue, calls the mechanists, the engineers. But there's also another faction. So the Navy of this period actually contains two types of officers. The mechanists, the guys who are really interested in technology and leveraging technology, and then the strategists, the guys who see themselves as strategists. King is sort of the dean of the strategist camp that has been founded by Admiral William Sims. So King is very much the strategist, and he will go to the Naval War College three times and go through the course at the Naval War College three times in his career because he's so enamored with learning how to do strategy.
So on that, one of the things that Dr. Nance and I have talked about a lot is, in the interwar years Army, particularly given budget constraints, a lot of times what you do is you go to the school, then you come back to the school as an instructor. Or you go to the school, then you go to West Point as an instructor. Is it the same in the Navy, or is there a difference?
Well, again, it eventually becomes like that.
Yeah.
But this period is so full of change, and a Navy education, remember, is at the forefront of professional military education in the United States. Naval War College is founded almost 20 years before the Army War College is founded. And so the Navy, when King goes through Naval War College, he's a relatively junior guy. I think he's either a lieutenant commander or a commander, and he goes through something called the short course. He doesn't feel he's gotten enough, so he goes through the long course, and then he comes back to the Naval War College and goes through an updated version of the course. But he never ends up on the faculty like Raymond Spruance.
So
Spruance will do that. King never serves as the president of the Naval War College, which is also a stepping stone to high command, like Sims does, and like Admiral William V.C. Pratt will do, and like Spruance will do after the war.
Right.
So King never goes back to the faculty because he's too valuable. I think what people forget is King is a captain
right.
in the 1920s.
Which is a colonel in the Army.
Right, and he's a captain who is at the very forefront of everything that's going on in the Navy to deal with the Washington Conference and the problem of Japan. And so King is entirely focused on how to operationalize War Plan Orange, how to win against the Japanese in the Pacific, and how to leverage especially naval aviation to do that. So when the Morrow Board meets in 1926, part of the Morrow Board's recommendations, which also lead to an Assistant Secretary of War for Air, they give the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Air, but what it says is that only naval aviators can command aircraft carriers and naval air stations. But they don't have anybody senior enough. They don't have enough 06s and 07s to command. And the Navy also already has a structure for aviation command at flag rank. And so what happens is a bunch of guys like William Halsey and Slew McCain, John McCain's grandfather, and Ernie King go back through flight training.
Hmm.
And they are called Johnny-come-latelys. And King is a Johnny-come-lately, and he gets qualified to fly in the Navy. He earns his wings as a naval aviator pilot. And he becomes a huge advocate for naval aviation. And he becomes the he becomes the protege of Admiral William Moffett, who's the head of the Bureau of Aeronautics.
So one of the things that professional military education during the interwar period really struggled with is how to get the military ready for the next conflict. And there's a great book about the Command General Staff College called America's School for War. But what is the Naval War College doing to get its officers ready? So what's so useful about this course that King goes back three times to do? What do they do there?
Again, it's the Naval War College process. Ron Spector and Mike Vlahos have written extensively about it, as has Al Nofi. Who's the guy that used to be the president of the SMH? C.C. Felker. And Norman Friedman. So there's abundant scholarship on this, but essentially what the Naval War College does in the interwar period is they war game a war in the Pacific against the Japanese over and over and over again.
There's wonderful photos of this. There's an iconic floor that's black and white tiled, and there have been war games played on that by the Navy for a century. And there's great visuals.
And the organization of the Navy in the interwar period is not what it's going to be for the war. The Navy is organized into four main components. One is called the battle fleet. Another one is called the scouting fleet. Another one is called the logistics train. And the fourth and final one, which doesn't get much attention in the scholarship, is called the control fleet. Cybernetic warfare. Yeah. Okay, how do we control, command and control all this? And this is where NRL and voice radio and all that plays in, radar, all that kind of stuff. And so they're wargaming all of this at the War College, and King is involved in it. And he wants to see what's going on when he goes back to the Naval War College. Well, where are we at with this stuff? Because at the same time, King will go back to the fleet from these shore jobs or from PME, and he will be in command of an aircraft carrier. The Lexington. Mm-hmm. In fact, he'll be one of the first commanders of the USS Lexington. All right? And he will be the guy who will attack Pearl Harbor in Fleet Problem 9 with aircraft from the Lexington. All right? That's Ernie King as a senior captain. Ernie King will also become the commander of Naval Air Force's U.S. fleet, which is a flag job. So he'll get to see the Naval War College wargaming turned into annual fleet exercises that he'll participate in, and then they'll war game it. So they'll take the conceptual piece from the War College, and that's why he's going back and doing that. He wants to see, well, what are they doing here? How are we getting this stuff? And he's also working with the General Board of the Navy, where he's testifying before the General Board in Washington about, okay, how do we design these ships? What's the best carrier design? And King is very, very involved in that. And then in 1933, or is it 1934? Something happens. It's 1933. The USS Akron, a lighter-than-air dirigible, is testing the concept of an airborne aircraft carrier for the Navy. The head of the Navy's Bureau of Aeronautics, he's been the head of the Bureau of Aeronautics for almost 13 years, Admiral William Moffett, dies in an accident where the Akron crashes and everybody's killed, just like the Hindenburg and the Shenandoah. And all of a sudden, there's no head of naval aviation. Ernie King is made the head of the Bureau of Naval Aviation to replace Admiral Moffett. So that shows you how important he is.
Oh, yeah.
He basically becomes the head of anything having to do with naval aviation at one of the most key points in the 1930s when you're starting to write the contracts for a new generation of aircraft carriers and a new generation of carrier aircraft.
So let me pull a thread there, because we often think, particularly World War II, but kind of in general, we think naval aviation is carrier-based. Does this also include land-based aircraft?
Well, that's the problem, because another thing happens in 1933 that King massively protests as the brand new, and his predecessor also protested it when it was in the works. And that's when the Chief of Staff of the Army, Doug MacArthur, gets in an office with the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Pratt, and they come to the Pratt-MacArthur Agreement, which basically gives the strategic bombing mission, including operating long-range aircraft from land bases, to the United States Army Air Corps. And because of that agreement, the United States Navy will not be allowed to have long-range maritime strike bombers. Now, the Navy will get around that by building long-range maritime reconnaissance flying boats, which can also carry bombs.
Right.
And it'll be one of the secret weapons of World War II, the PBY Catalina.
Yes.
Well, who's the guy in charge of that program?
Who?
Ernie King, probably.
Ernie King. Okay, so Ernie King is involved in that decision as well. Every time you turn over a stone, you're going to see Admiral King's fingerprints on it, whether it's submarine policy, aviation policy, and even policy with respect to radar, battleships, and voice radio. King is this guy who's operating both in the fleet, testing the concepts, but also back in Washington with his fingers in all of these different weapons programs. And eventually he will end up in complete command of all of the aircraft carriers in the United States fleet before he goes to the general board. In fact, I think King doesn't become the commander-in-chief of the fleet, but he becomes commander-in-chief of a fleet prior to the fleet being reunified in 1939 after World War II starts. And this is where we can kind of talk about some of those other things about King which kind of start to emerge. Mm-hmm. Because there's a power struggle in the Navy. Who is going to lead the Navy as the security situation in the globe begins to degrade in the late 1930s? Is it going to be Kalbfus? Is it going to be this guy named Block, Claude Block? Is it going to be a guy named Clark? Is it going to be William Leahy? Is it going to be Betty Stark? And where does Ernie King fit in all of this? And at this point in time, Ernie King is actually on a pretty friendly relationship with President Roosevelt. I think President Roosevelt liked having Ernie King around because he was this dour, ultra-competent guy that Roosevelt could turn to shut up idiots that might be in the room with them. Because mm-hmm. King was really good at shutting up silly people that said silly things in the president's company. But the president used him kind of like an attack dog.
So he's a hyper-competent generalist who spent 15 to 20 years thinking iteratively about how to fight a naval warfare.
How to fight a naval war with Japan. Now, the fascinating thing here is King is on the general board, which scholars until me and Dave Conan came along have said, well, you know, Ernie King is put out to pasture on the general board. Absolutely not. The general board was where you sent guys to be as sort of a finishing class in strategy before you put them into major fleet command. And that's what happens to King. So King comes out of the general board in late 1940, December 1940, and because of what's going on with the Germans in the Atlantic, the Neutrality Acts and the creation of the Neutrality Patrol, King becomes the first ever commander since World War I of the Atlantic Fleet, because we do away with the Atlantic Fleet after World War I. I haven't even mentioned the Washington Conference because that would probably have wrecked this lecture. But King has been operating within the constraints of the Washington and London naval conferences this entire time. He's one of these guys who's saying, we got to build, and nobody will build. So when he becomes the commander of the Atlantic Fleet, he gets the final piece in his education as the greatest admiral since Horatio Nelson. Okay. In fact, he's better than Nelson because he gets the global perspective.
He also lives.
And he lives, yeah. It helps not being killed at a battle. And King commands ashore. King is a guy who leads the way on how to command ashore, how to command global naval forces ashore. He does go to sea quite a bit, but he never stays at sea. He always goes back to Washington to kind of run things and make sure things are being done correctly. Because in addition to commanding the largest navy in the world in 1942, which is when he gets the final command, he is also chief of naval operations, and he's also the main American member for the naval services on the combined chiefs of staff. In fact, the British Sir Alan Brooke will say the best strategist on the American side was Ernie King. I didn't like Ernie King, but he was the best strategist on the American side. And again, the British often regard him as an Anglophobe. He wasn't. I mean, why put him in charge of the Atlantic Fleet if he hates the British? He doesn't hate the British. Right. But he does know when the British are trying to pull the wool over the eyes of people like Eisenhower and Leahy and Marshall. And so he's an advocate for America, particularly in the early years of the war when he becomes CNO and then he becomes Commander-in-Chief of the Fleet.
What makes him say, hey, he's a good strategist? Because isn't it pretty straightforward?
Because he had the global perspective. Yeah. He knew how to prioritize. So strategy, as a friend of mine said, is about prioritizing. No, Ernie King totally backs Europe First. All right? It's his protege, Richmond Kelly Turner, who writes the Planned Dog Memorandum, that where Betty Stark shows George Marshall that the Navy thinks Rainbow Five should be a Europe First focused war plan for global war on against the Axis. All right, mm-hmm. Which is what Rainbow Five is. And so when that takes place, and then King replaces Stark at CNO, and then because of Pearl Harbor, he fleets up to become Commander-in-Chief Fleet, Commage. Not Sinkus Fleet, which he hated, because it implied that somebody was going to sink the fleet like at Pearl Harbor, but he became Commage, Commander-in-Chief of the Fleet. Everybody always forgets it's King as Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet. That's the King we're talking about here. The CNO is an admin job. It's not a command job. Mm-hmm. Commander-in-Chief of the fleet is the command job. And King will create the numbered fleets as a way to command this decentralized. King creating the numbered fleets is like Napoleon creating the army, the Corps d'Armée and the Grand Armée. And so when King creates 5th Fleet, 3rd Fleet, 2nd Fleet, 7th Fleet, and then eventually 10th Fleet, King is doing exactly what Napoleon did because this huge span of control he ends up having as the global commander of the most powerful naval forces on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so when he commands in the Atlantic and then he fleets up to be commander-in-chief, that the other reason is he studies strategy. He's a serious student of strategy. All serious students of strategy study the Napoleonic Wars, and Ernie King did that. Okay, so Ernie King was probably the most serious student of strategy in the Navy. The only guys that even come close to Ernie King are Dudley Knox and Ray Spruance, Raymond Spruance. Those are the only guys that even come. Bull Halsey's just a guy who wants to fly and chum around with aviators. So right, Thomas Kincaid is a talented guy, but he's not nearly at the level of a King or a Nimitz. Nimitz is the other guy. And again, Nimitz and King don't get along. It's one of the great dysfunctional partnerships of the war. When Nimitz doesn't think the Doolittle raid is worth the squeeze, and Nimitz is probably right in this case and King wrong. King is one of the guys who came up with the Doolittle raid. So and was fascinated by it. But it was King is also the one who said, let's do Guadalcanal. And Nimitz was like, I don't know about this idea, boss.
So let's dive into some of the stuff you've talked about, kind of wave tops, now that we're into World War II. So King is effectively the commander of the U.S. Navy throughout the war, acknowledging that Roosevelt has an interest in the Navy. Because he's Assistant Secretary of the Navy, like his family member. What does that mean for somebody who has these numbered fleets out, who has a war to fight in the Pacific, who has a war to fight in the Atlantic, and who has allies? What is he doing as the commander of the Navy?
So the thing about King is he is a cheerless workaholic who doesn't sleep. And he has almost perfect recall of facts. He's a Napoleon.
Or a Berthier.
So he's the guy who you can ask him something and you're going to think he's going to have to go to his staff to get the answer, and he'll answer it. One of the reasons is he's at all the conferences. He's at ABCD. He's at Arcadia. He's at Cairo. He's at Tehran. He's at all of them. He's at... He's the guy that's at the Washington Naval Conference that decides we're going to invade the Marianas in 1944. He's at that. So he's at all the conferences. But at the same time that he's representing the Navy's priorities, the U.S. Navy's priorities for defense of the United States and victory for the United States, he's very pro-American. Mm-hmm. Okay? If it comes down to privileging one particular nation, King is always going to privilege the United States over what he sees as a dissolving, obsolete British imperial system.
Which is interesting for a Navy person, because you could understand how a Navy person coming up might feels subordinated to the British as the great sea power.
No, he saw what the how the British handled things in World War I, and he became convinced that, yeah, an Anglo-American partnership, if another big war came along, was essential. But he was convinced that because Great Britain's problems with how to get their resources and produce them and all of the things that they had to do to protect this huge, rambling empire, that they couldn't do nearly as good of a job as an industrial power as the United States could. So they were not only going to have to play second fiddle to the United States in terms of material production, but they were going to have to play second fiddle to the United States when it came to strategy. And King, more than anybody else on the Combined Chiefs of Staff, although he and Marshall had a fascinating working relationship that emphasized this, made that happen. Hmm. They're the ones who put Alan Brooke and Churchill in their place.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that a little bit? Because there is no chairman of the Joint Chiefs for this operation. It is King and Marshall
working
together.
King, Marshall, and to a lesser degree, Leahy, although Leahy's more of a cipher for President Roosevelt, okay? People have said, well, Leahy's the chairman. No, he's not. Leahy's another four-star guy who has the ear of the president. That's a really great thing to have in an organization, particularly one as small as the Joint Chiefs of Staff, if we just get rid of all the staff guys and just keep the principal guys. So King and Marshall and Arnold, okay, are all pro-American, and so because they have the stuff, they control lend-lease, they know the production, and they know how to prioritize, they can, you know, they get their proverbial rumps handed to them at Casablanca. And King, Marshall, and Arnold, and Eisenhower all said, never again will we let the British tell us what to do.
Mm-hmm. And that's and that's January of 43.
Right. So up until early 1943, for the Combined Chiefs of Staff as an organization, the British really see themselves as the lead nation, all right, with all the strings of all the things going on for grand strategy. Even though everybody in the room knows that the Soviet Union is doing the bulk of the heavy lifting, including right. Ernie King, right? Ernie King's happy with the Red Army taking on the Germans so that the Navy, the Army, and the Marine Corps can go ahead and take care of the Japanese.
Right.
All right. So but that's when that happens. But that relationship, King and Marshall and Arnold are all they have the weight of opinion behind them, and because FDR valued these guys and their opinions, and Leahy too, so much, he would tend to go, well, Winston, you know, what you're talking about here. And Churchill was undermined by his own chief of the Imperial General Staff and the Imperial General Staff, who thought Churchill was a rank amateur when it came to operations.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting is you're highlighting, there's a lot of similarities in their personalities, perhaps, because Marshall was another straight talker, liked to work hard, and would tell his boss no bluntly.
Right. These are cold, aloof men. But when they see someone like themselves, they go, that's somebody I'm going to partner with. That's somebody I'm going to collaborate with. And as soon as the Air Force sees that the China thing isn't going to work for strategic bombing, they get in bed with Ernie King and go, we're supporting you, man, because you're going to give us those bomber bases in the Marianas. They're going to let us to hammer the Japanese, mm-hmm. all right, which is the whole reason we built this stupid B-29 aircraft, is so we can hammer the Japanese, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, yeah, it does, in its early concept phase. So King knows about this, and King knows air power. So he can, you know, Hap Arnold, when he talks to Ernie King, he's looking at a guy who's wearing a set of wings, mm-hmm. who knows how to fly an airplane. That means a lot to the air community, you know. Even though it's not really the great basis for trust and collaboration, that, hey, that guy knows how to drive a taxi, right? So I should listen to him. Because of that, it gives King cachet,
yep.
all right? And again, everybody can use Ernie King as the bad cop. And Ernie King's okay with that. He is absolutely okay with that. Let's talk about Ernie King, the bad cop. Women, booze, and cursing. First off, the cursing It's not cursing. It's King was acerbic. If somebody said something stupid that was a waste of everybody's time, King would call them out on the carpet in public. He had no problems with humiliating general officers in public, okay? Which I think is okay. I think they deserve to be humiliated in public if they say something stupid. You know, now, once, you know, when they're junior officers, yeah, humiliate them in private, but not in public. But because of that, King gets this reputation for having a filthy mouth. He's not using any more curse words, and Conan, in his biography of King, goes over this again and again. He doesn't use any more curse words than anybody else. Like, Bull Halsey and Slew McCain are saying just as many or more bad words
Patton.
Than Ernie or Patton are, or Ike, for that yeah. matter. Okay, let's deal with drinking. King is not a heavy drinker, but he will have a martini in the evening. In fact, he drinks far less than he probably could have. Every time he goes to see FDR, FDR offers him a cocktail. And most of the time, King will go, "No, Mr. President, I'm still working." So this idea that King is this drunkard is nonsense. King did drink, but he wasn't a drunkard. Now, were there flag officer drunkards during World War II at the highest levels of command in the United States? Yeah, there were, okay? There were those guys that would get drunk, you know, and where it would actually affect their judgment, all right? So there's that. And the final thing is women. Now, this comes from Buell, his biographer in King, Master of Sea Power, who is basically gotten confused, and he thinks he's writing the backstory for Pug McHenry in Winds of War. This is true. The Winds of War guy, who's that guy? He's same guy who wrote the same guy who wrote the Caine Mutiny. Anyway, Joseph Wambaugh, right?
Sounds right.
Anyway, so Buell is working with this guy, and then all of a sudden he goes, "Well, Ernie King is Pug Henry, right?" And so he conflates King's identity with that of his fictional character. And if you go back and you watch The Winds of War, you'll actually see the Robert Mitchum's portrayal of Pug Henry is a very good king in most respects, okay, except one. And that one has to do with fidelity in marriage and womanizing. There is absolutely no evidence that King ever had an affair at all with anyone. And there's scientific evidence from his flight physical. I think in the 1930s, it's in Conan's book, King is tested, and for some reason, I have no idea why, it might have to do with eugenics and all that stuff that were taking place at the time. They test King's sperm count, and King cannot produce children. In fact, it's probably a good bet, and this is probably another reason he's a workaholic, that King is impotent. Now, King has already had seven children with his wife at this point, who he's married to and never divorces, all right, for all you 21st century people, okay? But he gets a reputation of being flirtatious, particularly with Mark Clark's wife at one particular Washington cocktail party, where she chattily writes back to Mark Clark that King tries to pick her up and have a fling with her. Well, guess what? King flirted with her, but he couldn't make good on the flirt. All right, okay. So this idea that King was a womanizer is nonsense. The idea that he was a drunkard is nonsense, or that he even drank more than most World War II flag officers drank. I suspect he's a teetotaler compared to guys like Ike and Halsey. Yeah. There are other guys in the Navy who probably drink less than King. Maybe Ray Spruance. Certainly not Chester Nimitz. And then in terms of foul-mouthed language, all you have to do is spend a little bit of time with any naval officer and you'll realize they're all like that.
Yeah. So you painted a good picture of him both as a person and kind of how he got to where he was. Let's talk about how he managed the war. So let's start at the beginning. Once the U.S. gets involved in the war, the Japanese are handing the U.S. defeat after defeat, late 41, early 42. Things are not great in the Atlantic either. So how is he balancing these two, 180-degree separated oceanic problems early in the war?
Yeah, he's one of these guys who has an ability to multitask to a level at the higher strategic levels, Theater Command and Global Command, that's rare in the history of warfare. And again, you know, you have to go back to like the War of the Spanish Succession and the Duke of Marlborough or the War of the Seven Years' War and the various and William Pitt or somebody like that to find people that are like King that have that sort of command of all these of the geography in the different theaters. And King is one of those guys. So we have to remember, the first thing I need to emphasize for the listeners is King takes over a system that's already there.
Yeah.
All right? Now, it's a system he's been a part of and that he knows intimately. All right? But that system is already there, all right, when he takes it over. And then he slowly, he doesn't all of a sudden take over. He's chief of naval operations first. That gives him the power of assignments. Who's going to get assigned where to do what? One of his great misassignments is going to be Bob Gormley for the South Pacific because mm-hmm. Gormley's a brilliant planner. And so he sends Gormley down to command COMSOPAC, and Gormley's just a complete failure at that. Another guy who it seems like is somebody that's going to be a good commander is William Pye. And that's who King wants to command the Pacific Fleet, either Pye or somebody else. And Dave Conan, it's in Conan's book where he talks about it. But instead, he has Chester Nimitz foisted on him. And Nimitz has to prove his worth to King. So the first piece of the management is talent management.
Okay.
And King does an exceptional job of that. Okay,
So you're highlighting that some people are maybe better in the office and some people are better on a ship.
But he's not perfect. Okay, yeah. There are people that he doesn't like. He doesn't like McCain. He doesn't like Nimitz. He doesn't like Jack Fletcher. All right, but he lets Jack Fletcher command three carrier battles. All right, he doesn't remove him. All right, but when he hears from John McCain, the first McCain, everybody, not the third one, that Fletcher's tired out. He not only removes Fletcher, he removes McCain, and they're both brought back to shore duty to kind of give them a rest.
Yeah.
And Nimitz had said, yeah, they need a rest. So there's the talent management piece. The other piece is he is a full partner in the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Combined Chiefs of Staff, and so he helps manage the Navy by looking out for the Navy interests and priorities at these conferences,
right?
All right, at these conferences. And so the reason we're on the offense in 1943 in the Pacific is because of Ernie King. There's nobody else who wants to be on the offense in 1943 in the Pacific other than Ernie King. Not Chester Nimitz, not Ray Spruance, not Franklin Roosevelt, certainly not anybody from the British side of the Combined Chiefs of Staff. Hap Arnold, yeah, he wants to get the combined bomber offensive going with Spatz and those guys. And George Marshall just wants to open up a second front in Europe.
Right.
The only person that wants to go on the offensive in the Pacific in 1943 is Ernie King. And that's what happens. So you got to think, you know, so that's management. That's management. When you get your way with something that nobody else wants and you figure out how to resource it with the limited resources you have. And, oh, by the way, you've got this spoiled child in Australia also screaming for resources. But you've got an ally in George Marshall who doesn't like that spoiled child, and you've got an ally in Dwight Eisenhower who doesn't like that spoiled child, Doug MacArthur. And so he can get his way.
Right.
And so he gives all of the ships in the Pacific to Chester Nimitz, and then he lets Nimitz be the bad guy that doesn't let MacArthur have those ships unless Nimitz says, okay, I'm going to give you a couple ships here and there, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how it works. And then in 1944, he creates the numbered fleet system to decentralize command of these major theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And so 5th Fleet will be the Central Pacific. 7th Fleet will be the South Pacific. 2nd Fleet will be the Atlantic. 3rd Fleet will be hemispheric defense in the Eastern Pacific, and then 10th Fleet will be the U-boat battle.
Mm.
And he'll command directly. He'll command 10th Fleet directly, even though he'll have an action officer called McCann, Admiral McCann, who will sort of be his deputy commander running the show. And so this is a talent management thing. But remember, he's got his fingers in all of this. He'll actually get involved with operational decision making. Mm-hmm. I mean, he will say, no, I want to do, I forget what the invasion of Taiwan Formosa is called. It's like Conway or Four-Way, or it's in Conan's book. But, you know, the code name for the invasion of Formosa. King actually tries to get that operation approved, and it's one of his rare failures in the war that he doesn't manage to override the invasion of the Philippines in favor of the shortcut to Formosa and Taiwan.
So, dumb question. When King is working in Washington, eventually in the Pentagon, can he just call a fleet commander?
Yes.
On the phone?
No. So the way they did it back then, he could call fleet commanders if they were in the telephone system of the United States. Now remember, the Navy is in bed with ITT and ATT in the interwar period.
Right.
So some fleet commanders he can pick up the telephone, but most of them he communicates with on HF teletype, Morse code.
Yeah.
All right. And he'll send them messages like Lincoln sitting at the Naval Observatory or the Navy Yard, communicating with Grant and Sherman via telegraph.
Okay.
So he's got his own commands, but in the Atlantic in particular, it's a multinational fight.
Right.
With the Royal Navy.
Right. And
how does he coordinate that piece?
So he coordinates that via his job as a member of the Combined Chiefs of Staff, where he gets to talk directly with the First Sea Lord. Which is Dudley Pound, and then it becomes Cunningham, I think. And so he works with these guys. And he's initially not real big on the British coming back to the Indo-Pacific. And when we say Indo-Pacific, we really mean Indian Ocean, Pacific Ocean here. He's not really big because he thinks the British are going to have priorities that are going to privilege reestablishing the empire instead of defeating Japan.
Right.
But eventually he's convinced, yeah, that's a good idea. And in fact, once he gets in on that, he supports that fully.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how he works with the British and does that. Those machinations is through the First Sea Lord. All right.
What's his relationship with them like?
Well, it's like the relationship in any coalition. He's on this supranational organization called the Command Chiefs of Staff, and they have most of their conversations at the conferences, where they'll talk directly, but they'll have after-conferences in places like London and Washington, where they'll... Because remember, the British will always maintain a liaison officer in Washington, and so they'll... But King is always very involved in what I call these sort of secondary-tier conferences that take place, particularly if they involve naval forces. So that's where he really gets... Where he really exercises himself as Cummings. He will direct things sometimes. The Guadalcanal campaign is a great example of King as commander-in-chief of the U.S. fleet saying, we're going to do this operation and here's what we're going to do it with. I don't care what you guys are saying. We're going to take the 1st Marine Division and we're taking the Pacific Fleet and we're going to go conduct this. We're going to put every single aircraft carrier we have in it and we're going to put everything that we have into this operation.
So, question on the Atlantic part before we skip back to the Pacific, and
this is a good question
based on what I do.
Yeah,
you've talked about the British,
right?
There is also a fairly substantial French fleet in the Caribbean for most of the war. It's essentially docked there, but it's kind of a fleet in being. And there's another one that Churchill attacks at Mersa Kabir early in the war. Does this factor in at all? Are King and the other combined?
No, King is totally aware of the problem of the French.
Right.
Right? When he's in command of the Atlantic Fleet doing the neutrality patrol and basically doing gray zone warfare with Nazi U-boats, he is aware that the French are something of an enabler for the U-boat war that's creating so much consternation. He's already, again, going back to Bill's question and your question, he's already working with the British on this, coordinating
right.
and everything with the neutrality patrol, all right? So this idea that King doesn't know anything about ASW and he's totally focused on the Pacific to the detriment of the Atlantic is nonsense. You know, when the Germans do drumbeat, they take everybody by surprise, and it's still very early in the war. So all of those, you know, we have a hell of a time just kind of getting things across the North Atlantic through the Greenland, Iceland, United Kingdom gap. And now we've got this whole problem in the Caribbean.
Right.
And we have to worry, well, what are the Vichy going to do? And how do they play into all
this? I want to play on that a little bit, because drumbeat, the second happy time, kind of the spring of 42, we have substantial issues because we're not convoying on the in the Atlantic seaboard to start off with. The cities are all lit up.
So you always have to ask the question, why aren't we convoying?
And so how does he fix those problems, right?
So Drumbeat is an audacious operation that Dönitz comes up with. And Raeder. We always forget Erich Raeder was also involved in the approval and execution of Drumbeat. In fact, if it hadn't been for Erich Raeder, the Germans would have never been able to execute Drumbeat because they wouldn't have had the numbers of Type 9 long-range submarines to do it that made Drumbeat so lethal in the Gulf of Mexico.
And
all right,
and the Milkos and all that.
But up until Drumbeat occurred, the Germans were not attacking shipping in those areas. They weren't attacking along the Atlantic coast, in part because of the neutrality patrol. They didn't want the Americans in the war, but they absolutely weren't attacking in the Caribbean. Who's in command of the Atlantic Fleet when the Germans are not attacking? So do you have to come up with systems to combat the U-boat when U-boats aren't attacking somewhere? No, you don't. Should you have contingency plans to do that? Sure, you should. How long does it take to get all the ships to sail to ports of amalgamation and aggregation in order to form convoys? And how do you do that?
And would
you do that
ships.
With wireless telegraphy?
Yeah.
Which means an oiler that is halfway to Jamaica gets an HF signal that says you need to return to Galveston and wait for destroyers and 40 other oilers before you set out to deliver oil to, you know, North Africa or something like that. The other thing that's going on that everybody forgets about is Torch, which is gobbling up assets to do this power projection piece, all right? And you've got a U-boat war in the North Atlantic that's gobbling up all these assets. And you have German surface raiders that are still a threat. So you got to remember all these things. Now you start to understand, oh, okay, this is a pretty different... And at the same time, you're trying to keep the Japanese from taking Midway and Noumea and New Caledonia in the Pacific.
And oh, by the way...
Same time frame.
And oh, by the way, the ships we're talking about are not all U.S. military ships.
Right.
They're civilian ships, and there's a civilian component that comes into this.
Too. Right. There's a civilian component that comes into this. I mean, convoys are a very inefficient way to deliver goods and services because we think about it as a demand call, right? And so it's much more economically efficient, and it's much more efficient in terms of delivery not to convoy, right? And so why convoy if it's inefficient if you don't have to? So once Drumbeat begins, well, it's already too late, right? So now you begin to convoy and put everything together and react. But there's a great new book coming out that really tackles this head on. And so everybody's kind of interested in like, okay, why did Ernie King have such a hard time dealing with Drumbeat and the humiliation of Drumbeat? John Parcell has come out with a new book on 1942 where he looks at all this global strategy. Hmm. There's some other scholarship out there that said, but you know, this is one of the myths about King, is that King is a battleship, aircraft carrier guy. He doesn't understand submarines, and that's why the Germans kick our butt in Drumbeat, which is nonsense because King knows about submarines. King is the father of the unrestricted submarine warfare against Japan.
Hmm.
He doesn't go into Roosevelt and say, don't do this.
Right.
He's like, absolutely, these submarines are ideal. The Germans are doing, we're going to do it. And we forget that.
So if I remember right, the second happy time only lasts about 6 or 7 months before he gets the fixes in place.
Right. And the fascinating thing about this is something the Germans can only do once.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, by the time they get the convoy going, but it spurs the development of new tactics that King has been favoring called hunter-killer groups with escort carriers. So even though there's this horrid need for escort carriers and carriers in the Pacific, King will start to channel escort carriers personally to the Atlantic fight for the hunter-killer operations against the Germans as the Germans decide to use the Central Atlantic as sort of a logistics base for their Milchkow and their U-boats. But they'll never do drumbeat again. By the time they set up... Now, this is a great system because once this system is set up and because of Lend-Lease, after World War II is over, it's still pretty much in American hands, and it'll be ideal to deal with the Soviets for the war against the Soviets. So we'll have bases in all these different former British bases or still British bases all over. But King is one of the architects of that. And again, this is a hard time for King, this period. From February 1942 until the end of Drumbeat, which is the summer of 1942, we have Midway, we have Coral Sea, Singapore Falls, there are convoys that are going to get massacred off of Murmansk. This is a horrible period of global warfare. You know, never mind Stalingrad, Case Blue, Burma falling, and all these other things going on, and the fact that India is actually threatened during this time period. So this is an absolutely trying to prioritize how you're going to use your assets. And King does a pretty good job. You know, to expect King to have anticipated that the Germans were going to modify Type 7 U-boats and use the entirety of their Type 9 fleet to do this audacious operation. Somebody has said, I don't know if it's Mark Milner or Evan Maudsley, or maybe even Paul Kennedy in his book, they've said that Drumbeat actually sets the war back by 2 weeks.
So let's talk about kind of where this is heading into the Pacific. And you've touched on this earlier, but the book I've always heard is that King and Nimitz hated each other, and the Pacific War kind of went the way it went in spite of them, rather than because they were cooperating. Is that true, and what's the actual relationship?
So on the one hand, you have the Trent Hone camp, which is that Nimitz is this very gifted theater commander, or super theater of commander, because he's really at one point Nimitz is actually commanding like four theaters: the South Pacific, the Central Pacific, the North Pacific, and then providing assets for the Southwest Pacific. All right, the one ocean that doesn't get any resources is the Indian Ocean. And it's like, okay, Great Britain, you know, that's your baby, and they're like, well, we don't got anything. So the Indian Ocean is just sort of a write-off until 1944. So that's part of what's going on here in the Pacific. King regarded Nimitz as a fixer. Nimitz was a guy who worked in the Bureau of Personnel, just like McCain did. And so King did not like guys who were like political. And Nimitz was political. He got his job as Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet after Kimmel was fired because of his friendship with FDR. But FDR's also friends with Ernie King.
Right.
And so what happened is this mutual respect develops between King and Nimitz. But Nimitz, throughout the war, is absolutely certain that he's subordinate to King. And King never lets him forget that, all right? And so there's some resentment there.
Yeah.
There's other guys like Raymond Spruance who is fine. King's okay with him. King does have his golden boys. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately for us, one of those is Bill Halsey, who is good until he isn't.
Famously and, sailing fleets in their
Yeah, hurricanes. And eventually... King has to remove both him and McCain from command late in the war because of their errors. All right, Halsey's and King is when Halsey comes through Washington after Lady Gulf and after being removed for the second typhoon, not the first typhoon, second typhoon. King tells him, "Well, you were the man on the scene, and you had to make the decisions, and I'm not going to second guess your decisions." All right. But the point of the fact is that King did have something above a grudge against the guys he sort of saw as pure black shoes. And he sort of listened to John Towers, who was saying...
Help us out, black shoes?
Black shoes are surface warfare officers. And Ray Spruance and Ken Hewitt and Frank Jack Fletcher are all black shoes. Ken Hewitt's in the Atlantic. He's the guy who ends up being the commander of the European naval forces for Ike and for Devers. We always forget that Devers had a guy working for him when he was the Mediterranean Theater yep. commander, because we always forget Devers commanded the Mediterranean Theater. But
we always forget the Mediterranean.
We always forget the Mediterranean. Okay, but the French on the South Coast, the French don't forget it, because yeah. you pull in there on a ship, they love you. But anyway, the Cote d'Or. Anyway, I'm reminiscing. So again, these relationships in the Pacific are very, very important. And King does have his guys. He does make some, but overall his management of these guys is pretty loose. And so is Nimitz's. Nimitz keeps a pretty loose hand on the tiller. King is, some people have regarded King as too directive, but he's the guy who puts this system in place with guys like Spruance, Nimitz, Kincaid, Hewitt, McCann, between him and the actual guys in charge of carrier task forces and ASW task forces and naval amphibious forces. And so he's only got himself to blame because he can't reach through these levels he's created to command the war. And I don't think he blames himself. He's like, it helps him sort of fight his worser nature sometimes to micromanage. I will concede that King has a tendency to micromanage. But look at what he micromanages and you'll go, well, actually, that turned out pretty well. Okay? There's a couple cases where it doesn't. All right? The Doolittle raid turned out well, but it was one of those things that shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. Right? And you put all the, loose cannons in charge of it. Doolittle and Halsey. I mean, these are loose cannons that you're risking 50% of the American carrier force in this raid to do.
Right. So one of the major architects of victory in World War II, I think it universally accepted. Give us a very brief sketch of his life and career after the war.
There's not much. Okay, and I've looked at this. This is in my book, My History of the General Board. I talk about King after the war. Now, King's one of these guys. During the war, the General Board becomes a place where, my thing is that King turns the General Board, which had been the premier strategy, almost like the grand strategy shop of the Navy, almost like a RAND or a CNA, except it's staffed with active duty admirals who tell you what kind of ships you can build, right? During the war, King kind of sends all the guys that fail there. That's the myth.
Yeah.
That's not the reality. I actually pose the myth because I'm thinking of saying, well, this is the reality. And then I find, no, that's not what happens. So J.O. Richardson, Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet before Kimmel, gets fired in 1940 because he tells Franklin Roosevelt, we shouldn't base the fleet in Hawaii. It's vulnerable here to an attack by the Japanese. So he gets fired. Okay. Where does he go? The General Board. Okay. Hart commands the Asiatic Fleet, which is obliterated by the Japanese. Even though Hart manages to get most of the fleet away, it ends up still being destroyed in a series of battles in the Java Sea and these other places as the Japanese unleash, their three-dimensional blitzkrieg in the Pacific. And so he's sort of a loser. He goes to the General Board, but he's also the Navy's top expert on submarine warfare. Richardson is the Navy's top strategist other than King. All right. Fletcher goes to the General Board. All right. So all these guys go to the General Board. So King doesn't get rid of them. He uses them. Fletcher, they're going to bring back for the invasion of Japan. Richardson is put in charge of the Unification Committee, where he says unification's a bad idea, creating an independent air force is a bad idea. But he's the minority opinion on the report, even though he's the chairman of the committee. And then who's the other guy? Hart. So during the war, that's what King does with the board. But after the war, King has implemented this policy of mandatory retirement. He has to retire. And for 2 years before he has his stroke, he's very involved, and he sees that Nimitz is a bad choice for CNO. Mm. And Nimitz, after the war, is not a very good CNO. King says he's not fighting this drive towards an independent Air Force and this drive to unify the services and put the Navy under the thumb of a Secretary of Defense who will probably be under the control of the air power guys. Even though King is an air power guy himself, he doesn't like the Air Force air power guys because of their total commitment to this idea of the war-winning potential of strategic bombing, which he sees as another thing you can do, but not the only thing you can do. So he's real worried about unification. So what he does is he brings back the General Board. He criticizes Nimitz. He says, we got to get somebody as the CNO other than this guy who keeps rolling over and trying to get along with these hard-to-get-along-with people like Bradley and Vandenberg, all right? And so he creates this super General Board with John Towers, four-star admiral, commander-in-chief of all the Pacific Air Forces at the end of World War II, as the chairman of the General Board, with Arleigh Burke and McCann and Sock Morris and all these guys on the General Board as the sort of high. And he's fighting unification. You can see some of his stuff at Key West, but he's behind the scenes. Then he has his stroke, and that's the end of Ernie King as a player. Okay. Right? But he's trying to shape things away from what he sees as this disaster that's going to take place. You know, I don't know when he has a stroke. I got to look in here. I think it's in 1947 he has the stroke. But it may have been when the 1947 National Security Act was passed. That's what may have killed Ernie King, because he definitely hated unification. He did not think the system that won a global naval war against the Axis in 1941 to 1945 was a bad system that needed replacing with an untested unified system on an army model.
Right. So we started this by saying the book on King was very skilled, obviously architect of victory, but what would you say is the proper assessment of Ernest King?
Oh, I think there's truth in all these myths. He is a ruthless guy. He's a ruthless bureaucratic fighter at every level. And he turns out to be really, really good at bureaucratic infighting at the very highest levels of policymaking. That makes him a good grand strategist if he has a good strategic vision. He had a great strategic vision. The United States is the global hegemon using naval and air power with an army and a Marine Corps that could get overseas courtesy of the Navy and the Air Force, okay? Primarily the Navy, all right? So that was his strategic vision, all right? Probably the best strategist of World War II. That's his legacy. He really was the best strategist of World War II. The problem is the system he created a system that would work without an Ernest King at the top.
That's the Napoleon problem.
Right. Well, we never gave that a chance.
Right.
All right? We'll never know. Because after the war is over, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. fleet goes away. They eliminate that unity of command that you've got. The CNO becomes more of a guy who's going to train and provide weapon systems. And even though he's still trying to be operational, sort of, but the numbered fleets that Ernest King created become the dynamic for 1945 until 1981, when the numbered fleets start to get scaled back and turned into these silly things called Joint Maritime Component Commanders, JIFMCs. So where they become tools for combatant commanders, and you get a deglobalized, decentralized, deunified approach to global strategy. All okay. Right. So that's his legacy, I think. He's some of what he did is still with us today. The numbered fleets are Ernie King's babies. Is it time to bring back Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. fleet? Well, I published an article on it in Expeditions for Marine Corps University Press, and I argue yes, it's time to bring Commage back.
All right, so it sounds like Ernest King will always be with us. Dr. Kuhn, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.